This is a recording for Professor Burke's class, Criminal Procedure. It is November 11th. This is podcast number one, and it's in room 238. Thank you.
Should know is reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. Now that test in it And we'll be contrasting this to the Sixth Amendment test for interrogation when we get to that probably on Thursday. But notice that the language of Innis, which governs what interrogation is for Fifth Amendment purposes, for Miranda purposes, is that objective, right? It doesn't really look to what the police officers might have been thinking, right? The police officers in Innis clearly wanted to know where the girl's body was. They wanted the guy to incriminate himself. That's why they were having this conversation with each other about wouldn't it be sad if some poor little handicapped girl got out of school and found the gun and wound up shooting herself. They clearly had a motive and intention to get him to incriminate himself, right? But what the court looks to is, well, is it reasonably likely to work? And the court doesn't seem to think that what happened to him amounted to interrogation because it shouldn't have worked. Yeah, the police were trying to get it, but it's ludicrous that it actually worked. The guy should have had more fortitude. It shouldn't have been reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response because it's not like he had some special sympathies for little handicapped girls, right? We're all supposed to be pretty tough, and if you hit the gun where little handicapped girls can find it, too bad. You're not supposed to incriminate yourself. That shouldn't have worked. So it doesn't seem to be looking at what the police officers are trying to do. It instead seems to focus on the sort of objective test of whether or not it reasonably would have worked. That's the best I can give you in terms of what lower courts and scholars have tried to kind of parse apart why the result in Innis is what it is. Okay. Clearly, it's not about the defendant's, sorry, it's not about the police officer's subjective intention. A couple places where in application the Innis test becomes more clear are sort of some categorical places where the court has removed certain conversations outside the context of Miranda. One of those are questions that are attendant to the booking process. So even if the answer winds up incriminating the defendant, if it was part of the usual booking routine, your name, where you live, height, weight, you know, sometimes they'll ask you income as part of a bail. Well, I shouldn't go that far. But things that have to do with booking, identification, those things are attended to booking and not interrogation. You see, I put there for undercover investigation. So an undercover police officer passing himself off as a peer or a friend to the defendant or somebody who's been recruited to serve as an informant, right, who's passing himself off as being something other than an informant, that doesn't trigger the same inherent inequity that the court was concerned about in Miranda, this kind of all the police against the defendant incommunicado, all of those psychological pressures that are attendant to custodial interrogation aren't raised when the defendant thinks mistakenly that he's talking to a peer. So the court pulls that totally out of Miranda. So when you see a defendant talking to someone that he doesn't realize is a police officer or an agent of the police, that's not going to be a Miranda issue. One thing we did not yet get to is the public safety exception. The Quarles case was the one little piece of that block of reading we didn't get to last week. You can put this wherever you want to put it in your notes, as long as you know it, obviously. One way to understand it is an exception to Miranda. Right, all those exceptions to Miranda that we talked about, impeachment, right, fruits of the poisonous tree, some of the exceptions to Miranda, you consider it there. Right? The other way to consider it is that it's not really interrogation. Okay? But the facts in Quarles, this is the case where the police were trying to apprehend a rape suspect, and the victim had identified her assailant and said that he had a gun. They chased him into the market, into this grocery store. He's got a holster, right, which corroborates her statement that he had a gun. Problem is there's no gun. That means the gun went somewhere, right? It's somewhere, and once again, we don't want little kids finding guns, right? So the police don't Mirandize him. They corner him in the grocery store and say, where's the gun? He says it's over there. Well, that allows them not just to secure the gun for safety reasons, it incriminates him, right? It ties him to the weapon, which helps shore up her identification because she said the guy had a gun. It links him to that weapon. It That's good evidence that he says there is a gun. The court in Quarrel refused to apply Miranda in that circumstance. And the court's opinion is pretty interesting, right? Because in other Miranda contexts where the court created exceptions, there was a tendency to say, well, yeah, the police should have Mirandized the guy. Right? They screwed up. They should have Mirandized the guy. They shouldn't have gotten that statement. But we get enough deterrence if we suppress the statement from the government's case in chief. We'll still let the government use the statement to impeach, right? Because the statement is reliable and we trust it and it's probative and it's got value. But the police really shouldn't have done that. They should have Mirandized the guy. What's interesting about the court's opinion in Quarrel is they don't want the defendant Mirandized in that situation. They actually think Miranda would be doing a disservice. But they don't. This wasn't a mistake. This is why I put the public exception, public safety exception here. But I don't think the court is saying there was a Miranda violation, but we're not going to give a remedy. The court seems to be saying this wasn't a Miranda violation. We're not going to construe Miranda so broadly that the police in the Quarrel situation would have had to stop Mirandizing the guy. If they stopped Mirandizing the guy, some innocent person in the grocery store might find a gun. That's a really bad thing. We don't want Miranda to interfere with public safety. The court, to me, I read Quarrel as saying this is not a violation at all. It's not a situation where there is a violation, but they're going to let the government use the proof anyway. I don't see it that way. That's why I put it here in the notes. Even like the book does it kind of differently. I think the court is saying this is an interrogation. We don't want to construe the word interrogation to mean situations where the questions are necessary, not as part of an investigation, not for the purpose of incriminating the person, but because of public safety, okay, because of exigency, that the government, it's good to ask these questions without Miranda. If you read the language of the opinion, is that clear? The justices don't seem to just be saying this is bad that we're going to let them use the evidence anyway. They're saying this is good. We want the government to be able to ask questions without Mirandizing people first if the questions are related to public safety. Okay, your casebook gives you a few notes. I mean, the Quarrel case itself, right, the facts are pretty unusual and pretty powerful. There's a gun lost in a grocery store that they haven't apparently cleared out yet. And they need to find it. So your casebook gives you some lower court decisions with Quarrel that show how broad the public safety exception can be construed, with lower courts going so far as to say that if during a traffic stop, if a police officer is about to do a Terry frisk, it's very common for police officers to say, you don't have any needles on you, do you? Right? They don't want to frisk somebody and get poked by some drug addict's hypodermic syringe. Right? So they'll say, do you have any needles on you or other drugs? Courts have gone so far to say that entire question is part of a public safety exception. Seems to me that maybe the needles question could be separated out from drugs. If the courts tend to be a little more deferential to officer safety, we saw that in the Terry context, right? And you'll see that in this context as well. If the question seems to be that it was not for the purpose of getting the defendant to incriminate himself, it was more about protecting the safety of the officer during the frisk, courts have applied Quarrel to those questions. All right, are there questions on the public safety exception? Again, I put it here in my, if I were outlining sort of one of those pulling out by the court of what's interrogation. So, not an interrogation if it's related to public safety, if it's a booking question, or if it's undercover. If it's not custodial interrogation, right? If it's neither custody, if it's either not custody or not interrogation, it would fall out of Miranda that way. Now, you guys know how this works, right? For analysis purposes, a good lawyer, a good defense lawyer might say, a good prosecutor might say, I think I'm going to win this motion to suppress by arguing it's not custody. If it's not custody, no Miranda warnings are necessary, I'm going to win. But a good prosecutor should say, okay, well, what if I lose on that threshold question? What if the court thinks this is custodial interrogation? Then what? well, then there have to be warnings. Okay? And that's just, that's a factual determination. That either happens or it doesn't. I told you just anecdotally, based on my own experience, there's not as much disagreement. You would think that the drug docket might be full of cases in which police officers said, Brennan is right, and the defendant said, no, they didn't. They never read me my rights. You would think that there would be these lying disputes, right, or someone's lying. It really does not happen. That really doesn't come up very often. Usually the fight is over whether or not there was a valid waiver or whether or not it rose to the level of custody. And we talked about the fact that police officers might not Mirandize a person because they don't think of it as an arrest, right? They don't think of it as an arrest. And therefore they don't Mirandize, and then the big fight is whether it was an arrest or not, right? So if there's custodial interrogation, there have to be warnings. That's a matter of fact-finding, yes or no. If no warnings were given, the effect of that is that if it's custodial interrogation and there's no warning, that statement is presumptively involuntary, presumptively compelled for Miranda's purposes. It's presumptively in violation of the privilege against self-incrimination. And then the third question, which is what we're going to talk about today, if the defendant was warned and then wound up incriminating himself anyway, the question is whether he waived the rights contained in the warrant. So that's what we need to talk about today, is how you know whether or not there's been a voluntary waiver. If there's not been if there's either been no warning or not a valid waiver, that's a problem, right? And this is just review from last week. The result of that is if the police engaged in custodial interrogation without a warning or a waiver, and there's no exigency like in quarrel, the statement is suppressed from the prosecution's case in chief, but the statement can be used to impeach, right? And also the fruits of the statement can be used. The fruits of the statement can be used, I don't know whether to keep talking about that or not, because part of it is just learning it. It's counterintuitive, hopefully, because I did such a great job teaching you the fruits of Poison's Tree Doctrine and the Fourth Amendment that you might be tempted to apply it here as well. So you kind of have to unremember something for a limited purpose. Right, that it's really just a statement, the fruits of that statement come in. It is counterintuitive to me. It's counterintuitive. So it's more a matter of just remembering that. So just to be clear, in quarrels, let's say in quarrels, I'm trying to change the facts so it wouldn't be. Let's say they chased him into. Like a closed gym. He runs into a gym that's closed, I don't know, making it kind of crazy. And they know for a fact that there's no one around. There's no one around but the guy and the police who are getting there trying to arrest the guy. And they say, where did you buy the gun? And he says, I put it over there. There might be an issue of whether or not that question was part of the public safety exception. I'm not sure how that would turn out, but let's assume the government loses that argument. Let's assume that some court says, I don't think that question was about public safety. The police weren't worried about anybody. Who were they worried about? They could just look for the gun. They didn't need to ask them that. They could Mirandize it first and then ask. What happened? And the defendant moves to suppress the statement and the gun. What results?
The statement might get suppressed if the gun was given.
Okay, the statement would get suppressed if the court didn't think it fell under public safety. Then you have custodial interrogation with no warning. So the statement would be out, but the gun would still come in. The first is still used. We could do examples all day long. Okay? The statement points them to a body, the body still comes in. The statement leads them to witnesses, the witness testimony comes in. The statement leads them to the loot from the robbery that he buried in the yard. The loot comes in. All about the statement. All right, let's talk about waiver, which turns out to be harder than one would think, unfortunately. So whether or not the defendant can be seen as having waived the rights that are contained within the warning turns very much on whether he has affirmatively invoked those rights or not. If you go back and you read the original Miranda opinion, the court seems to, I haven't sat down and talked to the five justices who were in the Miranda majority, but I'm pretty sure when you read that opinion that the court thought that they were doing something truly transformative. I mean, they really thought that they were leveling the playing field for defendants, right? They were worried about this unlevel playing field where police use tricks and pressure and loneliness and isolation and silence and fatigue and thirst and hunger and to do all of these things to make defendants feel weak and alone and then preyed on them. So the court is troubled by that enough to say, we're going to level the playing field. We're going to do something that was fairly unprecedented, which is to take lawyers and put them in the police station. Right. That's how we're going to make this playing field even. We're going to give the defendant an advocate on his side to embolden him, to give him, to make him feel less lonely, to look out for his interests, to tell him to keep his freaking mouth shut and stop, you know, because these defendants kept incriminating themselves over and over again, even though the court has said that statements could only come in if they were voluntary. So the court thinks it's doing something truly transformative. I think they pictured a world in which defendants would no longer confess and defense attorneys would regularly be physically present at the station house. The reality, the empirical reality, is they really haven't changed that much at all. The Miranda ruling really did not change that much on the ground empirically at all. It changed the world in the fact that police officers now carry little cards around that have Miranda warnings on it, and then they quickly memorize it and don't need the cards anymore. So it changed the world in that, you know, everybody who watches TV in America can recite Miranda warnings. But in terms of whether or not people confess, it really hasn't changed that much. And I think that's part of the reason why you saw police departments and government lawyers writing amicus briefs in Dickerson saying, don't reverse Miranda. Don't say that it's optional. Say it's a real constitutional right. It's because law enforcement doesn't think it gets in the way. Well, the reason why law enforcement doesn't think it gets in the way is because of the court's jurisprudence on waiver. If you go back and you read the original Miranda opinion, they seem to acknowledge, the court acknowledges that, yeah, maybe a defendant expressly could waive his rights in this rare case that they envision. But in reality, because the height of Miranda's jurisprudence was Miranda itself, and it's been all chipping away at it since then, post-Miranda, the court's been pretty, with the exception of people who invoke their right to counsel, which we'll talk about, generally the court has been not so skeptical about waivers. It's not that difficult for the government to prove waiver. And whether or not the government can prove a waiver, like I said, doctrinally, depends a lot on whether the defendant is deemed to have invoked his rights. If he never invokes them, there's no bright line rule. And the question is whether the defendant waived his rights voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently. Given what we talked about last week about what the court institutionally was trying to do to confessions jurisprudence by creating a bright line rule in Miranda. This is truly bizarre. I don't think this is what the original Miranda court envisioned. The original Miranda court really wanted bright line rules. They were dissatisfied with the case-by-case application of the due process standard prior to Miranda. They used Miranda as this vehicle to create bright line rules. But they have a bright line rule that says, read them their warnings, and then it's a question of whether you waive, but then the question of the answer on that question of whether the defendant waived puts us right back to a standard. Did they waive knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily, which is precisely what the due process standard requires, and which was so unsatisfying. So it puts us right back into voluntariness land. If you look at Connecticut versus Barrett, in this case book, what do we do with that for? Do you like go through and make it? So on page 761 is the case book. Your case book kind of, well, they give you a bunch of cases sort of right in a row about what is considered knowing and intelligent. Voluntary knowing and intelligent. What does it mean to be knowing and intelligent? In Connecticut versus Barrett, the defendant said he would talk. He agreed to talk, but said, I wouldn't sign anything. Well, the defendant argued after that that his restriction on that, I'll talk but I'm not going to write anything, showed that he was not knowingly being interrogated. It suggested that he mistakenly thought that unless it was in writing, it couldn't be used against him. Maybe he thought there was like a statute of frauds or something for confession. He thought it had to be in writing. He argued. I thought it had to be in writing or it didn't count. I was willing to talk, but not write. And the court said, no. It's still a valid waiver. Even though he did not understand the full consequences of his decision. It's a knowing waiver, even though he didn't know the full consequences of his waiver. So, the court really, where the court's jurisprudence has taken us to cure is that as long as the defendant knows the rights contained within the warning, that is enough to make his waiver of those rights known. He doesn't have to know the full implications of the waiver. He doesn't have to know how much trouble he's going to get into. He doesn't have to know the strength of the case against him, really, right? They could be lying to him about the strength of the case, and that's why he confesses. He doesn't have to know the strength of the case against him. He doesn't have to know the truth about whether his cohort flipped or not. All he needs to know for his waiver of Miranda to be knowing is the rights contained within the warning. Well, how is the government going to be able to prove that he knew the rights contained in the warning? Yeah, they read in the warning, right? On our flowchart, if we're down at waiver, it's because he got his warning. Well, he got his warning. In most cases, that's going to be evidence that he knew the rights contained within that warning. Similarly, remember Oregon versus Elstad? This was that case that we looked at for a fruits analysis, where he confesses the first time with defectively, right? There's no Miranda warning. He confesses the first time, that's out. It's defective because there was no warning. Then they Mirandized him. In a second interrogation at the police station. They Mirandized him, and then he confessed. Well, he lost his fruit of the poisonous tree argument. He wasn't able to suppress the second confession as the fruit of the first confession because the fruits of the poisonous tree doctrine doesn't apply to Miranda. He then tried to argue, okay, then fine. You can't prove a knowing and intelligent and voluntary waiver, because the only reason why I confessed the second time was because the cat was already out of the bag. Right? I thought that they could already use what I had previously told them against me. And that's why I repeated it. If they had told me, oh, by the way, your first confession is inadmissible, you have the right to remain silent, you have the right to counsel, even if you're indigent, now you want to talk to us, I would have said no. I didn't know that my first confession was tainted. The court said, too bad for you. You knew you had a Miranda warning. That's all you need to know. You knew you had a right to remain silent. You knew you had a right to a lawyer. You knew that if you couldn't afford a lawyer, one would be provided for you. And as long as you knew that, that's enough to make your waiver knowing and intelligent. Colorado versus Spring, similarly, next page, 762. He was originally arrested on a gun charge. They Mirandized him. He waived. And then they start questioning him about a murder. He confesses to that murder. And then he argues, wait a second. This wasn't a knowing waiver because I thought I was going to be questioned about guns. I was willing to be interrogated about guns. They didn't tell me that they were going to question me about a murder. And once again, the court says, so what? You knew that you had the right to be silent. You knew you had the right to a lawyer. You knew you had the right to have it paid for you if you couldn't afford it. All of that makes it knowing and intelligent. Voluntariness, we've been talking about what does it take for it to be knowing and intelligent. Usually the warnings themselves would be sufficient. Whether or not it's voluntary, ironically enough, this question, boy, it looks just like due process. It looks just like due process. All of the totality of the circumstances factors that we talked about, whatever we talked about, are now right back in play. Okay, so the reality is, even though Miranda jurisprudence was supposed to be governed by bright line rules, in most cases, it puts us right back where we started from. If you go and listen to, how many of you from the clinic or during internships or anything have been through a hearing about a confession? Well, I've been to them. Let me tell you how they go. Like I said, once you're past that threshold question of whether it's custody or not, that's where a lot of litigation takes place. There's not a lot of fights about whether or not there was a warning or not. It all boils down to waiver. So, picture how this works, right? The defendant is going to move to suppress based on due process and Miranda. He's almost always going to argue both. If it's arguably a custody situation, he's going to argue that there was a Miranda violation and a due process violation. In almost every case, the bottom line inquiry is going to boil down to the same thing. Because if he's moving to suppress, it means he confessed. It means he spoke. And the question then is whether he waived his warning. And that what turns on voluntariness. And due process turns on voluntariness. Because you wind up in the same place if he hasn't invoked his rights. What if the defendant is drunk and blows a .25? For those of you who know what that means, okay, .08 in New York, legally intoxicated. The defendant blows a .25, they Mirandize him, and he confesses away. I had 4 Long Island iced teas and I have never been so drunk. He moves to suppress based on a due process violation and a Miranda violation. He was arrested for doing Mirandized, asked how much did you have to drink tonight, sir? 4 Long Island iced teas, I've never been so wasted in my life. He moves to suppress the statement. What result? Yes. They might not need his statement, they might want a statement anyway. Juicy to tell the jury.
I don't know which one of those would be.
Is it a due process violation?
No, I don't think it's so shocking that they didn't ask questions. I was at
Okay, there you might get a different result, right? Because if he moves the suppress on due process ground, the issue is whether it's voluntary or not. It's very voluntary. He's quite eager to talk, right? He's proud that he's had no chance of wasting his life. Like, he's eager to tell the police about that. It's not involuntary to the extent that in some psychological sense it's involuntary because it's a product of being so drunk. Right, that's Colorado versus Connolly. Right, it wasn't induced by the government. Right, the government didn't force him to be drunk. They didn't induce the pressure on him to confess. That pressure was coming from his own lowered control. Right, he was drunk. So under Colorado versus Connolly, that would not be involuntary for due process purposes. It would, however, be a Miranda problem. And here's how the analysis would happen. He was in custody, he was interrogated, right, reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. Yes, he was warned, but did he waive? The Miranda waiver has to be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. It may have been voluntary, but it wasn't knowing and intelligent, because he's going to argue at a 0.25, I don't understand the right to remain silent, I don't understand the right to indigent counsel. Okay, I cognitively could not process that. Okay, so there's a cognitive aspect to waiver in addition to just the will question of voluntariness. Whose burden should it be to show waiver? Kimberly? Okay, government's burden, that was in Colorado versus Connolly case. And again, this is the difference. The court in Miranda originally talked about a heavy burden, right? It would be a heavy burden to show one of these hypothetical waivers that the court didn't think would happen very often. The court said valid waiver will not be presumed simply by the silence of the accused, or simply from the fact that a confession was in fact actually obtained. It suggested that the court was envisioning explicit waivers, like where the defendant signed something and said, I understand I don't have to do this, but I want to do this, and it would be a heavy burden to prove it. In reality, the burden is only by a preponderance of the evidence. That's Colorado versus Connolly. And in North Carolina versus Butler, you don't even know all these case names. But the court made it clear that a waiver of Miranda rights can be implied. It does not have to be expressed. It does not have to be an explicit statement by the defendant, I wish to waive. Now, in reality, you often get that. Oftentimes, they'll have the defendant actually sign a waiver if they think he's willing to do it. But that's the best proof of waiver. But it need not be signed, it need not be in writing, it need not be expressed explicit. It can be implied from the circumstances. Moran versus Burbine, your case book at 763. Here the defendant had been arrested for murder, so we know he's in custody. His sister went and got a lawyer for him, called the police station. The police told the attorney, don't worry, we're not going to be talking to him until tomorrow. In reality, the police were already in the interrogation room, going at it. The defendant waved. He agreed to speak to this. He winds up agreeing to talk to the detective. But he was never told that his sister got him a lawyer, and he certainly wasn't told that the attorney was actually asking for him, trying to get him. And the court found that there was no Miranda violation. Now, I think the result in Burbine gets at what it shows the direction the court moved in Miranda. The original spirit of Miranda pictures an active role for defense lawyers at the police station, right? It suggests that the police should not interfere with a lawyer who's trying to get to his purported client. He's been hired by the minister to represent this guy. But the way the court sees it, the focus isn't about the importance of lawyers anymore. It's about the defendant. Right? Did the defendant feel that he needed that help? If he felt he needed that help, he could have asked for a lawyer and he could have invoked that right. And he didn't have to wait. He was told what his rights were. He didn't want to exercise them. He chose on his own to speak. So the court did not think that there was a problem with that waiver. And again, it gets to this limited notion of what it is to be a knowing and intelligent waiver. The way I bundle all of these different cases together is time and time again, the court has said it's knowing and intelligent as long as the government shows that the defendant knew the rights that were contained in that warning and could understand. He doesn't have to know everything else, like the strength of the case, like the fact that there's a lawyer trying to get to him, like all of these other things. The reality is it's really not that hard to show waiver. I think your case book uses a lower court example of U.S. versus Frankston, which is somewhere there. It's a lower court opinion, but it's very, very typical of what these cases look like. The defendant was read his rights and then asked, "Do you understand that?" He said, "Yes." And then they ask if they start interrogating him, he answers. And just from that, the court found an implied waiver. So they didn't ask, "Are you willing to talk to us?" They didn't say, "Are you waiving your rights?" They didn't say, "Do you want a lawyer? What is your preference?" None of that. They read the warning. He indicated he understood them. That makes it knowing and intelligent. They asked him a question. He answered. At that point, unless there's a due process violation, right? Unless it's involuntary, there's also not going to be a Miranda problem. It boils down to that same focus. Okay, are there questions on that? So far, it's a pretty easy thing. Right? It looks a lot like due process. Where it gets harder is if the defendant invokes his rights. And the rationale here to try to make this a little intuitive, right, is in the case we just talked about, the garden variety case where the defendant just gets his rights read to him, says, "Yeah, I understand that," and then just starts answering everything. The court will infer from that an implied waiver, that implicitly we think that the defendant he must have agreed to this, because otherwise he wouldn't have answered those questions. He knew what his rights were, and he started answering questions voluntarily. We think that's a valid waiver. Once the defendant doesn't start answering those questions immediately, and says, "Actually, I'm kind of interested in those rights you were talking about," it becomes more difficult. I think the court's right on this, right? The court should be less quick to infer that the defendant was willing to just go along with this interrogation. If he stops and says, "Actually, I don't want to go along with this interrogation," it should be harder for the government to prove that the defendant really wanted to go along. Now, the court distinguishes between which right the defendant invokes. So let's talk first about invoking, because of course there's two different rights talked about in Miranda, right? There's the right to remain silent. That comes from the Fifth Amendment privilege itself. But there's also the right to a lawyer, a Fifth Amendment right to a lawyer, separate from the Sixth Amendment right to a lawyer, that's contained within those warnings and created for the first time in Miranda. So the court distinguishes between which right the defendant is invoking. Look at Michigan versus Mosley. Seven sixty-seven of your case book for guidance there. Solemnly here? Okay. So if the defendant's in custody and he's read his rights under Miranda and he says, "I'm not talking to you, go pound sand," What then? If the police ignore him and continue to interrogate him and he confesses, is that valid? Okay, no. Okay, so what could the police do instead? If you were a prosecutor advising the detectives, and they call you and they say, he told us he didn't want to talk to us and we should go pound sand, what would you tell them to do? Ask him immediately? He just said he didn't want to waive them. He said, I don't want to talk to you.
But,
okay, so they don't have to stay away from him permanently. But just to make clear that we're talking about the same thing, let's say, well, I guess because they called you, they left the room and left it by himself for a second. So let's say you're the detective. Let's not make you the prosecutor advising. If you're a detective and you're sitting across the table from the suspect and he says, F you, I'm not talking to you, you hand him a waiver form and say, sign it? Okay, but haven't you just ignored? He just said, I don't want to talk to you. You're still talking to him. How are you allowed to do that?
You're not allowed to talk to him, or you're not. I thought it was that you're not allowed to ask him questions.
Okay, you're not allowed to interrogate him, but the question is whether you're getting a valid waiver. So I guess I'm trying to figure out, if he first tells you, I'm not waiving, do we agree on that? If he says, F you, I'm not talking to you, that's a pretty clear indication that he's not waiving his privilege to remain, his privilege against self-incrimination. So how are you going to show, if your next move is, here's a waiver form, sign it for me, how are you going to show that's voluntary? As opposed to you overcoming his perhaps not articulately phrased, go away. What's a better way to show that you voluntarily? Okay. Yes, it does depend on whether, under the circumstances, you can show it's voluntary. But I'm not sure, given the court's jurisprudence here, that the police are going to be able to show it's voluntary if, on the heels of him saying, I'm not talking to you, that the next move is to try to get him to change his mind on that. The reason for that is the court says, if the defendant invokes his right to silence, that has to be scrupulously honored. So I guess the reason why I was pressing you, Solomon, is I wasn't sure that you were scrupulously honoring the FU request, right? To say, well, let's talk about this a little bit. I think a court would be reluctant to say that that's scrupulously honoring his I don't want to talk to you request. So what could the government do instead? Because Solomon's right, that I don't want to talk to you is not a permanent protection from interrogation. Okay, so in mostly the court says that the police have to scrupulously honor the right to silence, but that doesn't mean that the defendant can't voluntarily waive his rights after he's cooled off. So I think where I was going, I think Solomon was suggesting that perhaps the detective could give the defendant a cooling off period from interrogation while still pressing him for the waiver. I don't think that's the case. I mean, a cooling off needs to be a cooling off where he is separated from the inherent pressures of custodial interrogation. It's a matter of sort of a way of leveling the playing field, right? It's to give him a break from the pressures of custodial interrogation. And then revisit the issue. And the question is whether there's been a sufficient cooling off period. In Michigan versus mostly the defendant said he didn't want to talk, police stopped questioning, and put him in his holding cell. 2 hours later, a different police officer came in and asked to talk to him about a different crime. Re-Mirandized him. Gave him his warning again. And at that point, the defendant signed a written waiver and talked. Answered questions with that second police officer. And the court held that to scrupulously honor the defendant's invocation of the right to remain silent did not require a permanent cessation of questioning. Does not require a permanent cessation of questioning. The issue is whether they scrupulously honored it, and on these facts, they said that the police had. Now, that's not a lot of bright line rules there. I think the factors that were important in Mosley are that they did immediately stop. They did immediately stop. It was a different police officer 2 hours later. New Miranda warning in a different location. It was not part of that same interrogation session. It was, they listened to him. He said, go away, and they listened to him. And the court was seeing this as a separate session. Yeah, I mean, it mostly certainly helps that it's a different case altogether, but there's plenty of waiver cases you can find where it's the same crime. It's a question of whether, I mean, at the end of the day, it still turns on the standard of is it voluntary, knowing, and intelligent, and the question is whether the court is willing to believe it's voluntary, knowing, and intelligent, given that initially he said, I don't want to talk to you. So the question is, what has changed? If there's been this cooling off period, oftentimes there's a new, they re-Mirandize the person, so it's clear that he does still have those rights. It makes it easier to show a waiver. So it's a little harder. I mean, if you compare this, I've kind of put it in the order of easy to prove a waiver to hard to prove a waiver. Okay, so pretty easy to prove a waiver if the defendant never says anything about being reluctant to speak. If he said, I don't want to talk to you, it makes it harder to prove, but not impossible. Right? They can't ignore that. Right? They can't ignore what I'm calling it briefly. Right? They can't ignore the invocation of the privilege against self-discrimination. They can't ignore the request that he be left alone. Okay? It's a question of how long do they have to comply with that. There's no bright-line rule that says, oh, it has to be 2 hours or it has to be 5 hours. It's a matter of the totality of the circumstances of whether they think it's voluntary. All right, invocation of the right to attorney, that's the most protection the defendant can get against interrogation, and we'll talk about that after the break. So take a break till 10 hours.
Thank you.
Miranda including the Heidi Miranda and then all chipping away at it since then. Perhaps the one exception to that is Edwards versus Arizona, where the court really extremely protective of the spirit of Miranda and the defendants who invoked their right to counsel. In Edwards, the defendant was arrested for robbery and murder. He was read a Miranda warning and initially waived and tried to give his alibi story. Then invoked his right to counsel. He said, "Let's make a deal. I want a lawyer." The next morning, so much more than 2 hours than most. The next morning, after he says, "I want a lawyer so I can make a deal," two new detectives, so again, just like notably, different police officers. Whole half day later, two new detectives come in, re-Mirandize him, like in Mosley, and get a confession from the defendant. Now, the court held that that was not a valid waiver, even though everything about it almost looks like Michigan versus Mosley, right? Initial invocation of the right to Miranda, followed by a cooling off period, new detectives, re-Mirandized. The difference is which right the defendant invoked. Mosley invoked only the right to silence. The defendant and Edwards invoked his right to a lawyer. Now, I think the way to make this intuitive, which I'm always trying to do, I guess, is to think about what a defendant is saying when he's read his right. Right? A defendant who, like in Mosley, invokes only his right to remain silent, has chosen to make that decision on his own. Right? He's been told you have the right to remain silent and you have the right to a lawyer. And if you can't afford a lawyer, one will be provided for you. And his response says, "I don't want to talk to you," without mentioning a lawyer. That's an indication that he thinks he's capable of making these decisions for himself. And "I don't want to talk to you" might not mean forever and ever and ever. It might mean, "I don't want to talk right now. I hang up on my sister all the time. I don't want to talk," and I hang up because I don't like to talk on the phone. It doesn't mean I'm never going to talk to you again. It just means I'm tired. Leave me alone. That's what I'm going to try to make it intuitive. The court doesn't say that. The difference between Mosley and Edwards is Edwards doesn't say, "I don't want to talk to you." He doesn't make that decision on his own. He says, "I want a lawyer." That magic word, those magic words, "I want a lawyer," is an indication by the defendant, "I can't decide whether to exercise the privilege against self-incrimination on my own. I don't know what I'm supposed to do, or I don't have the fortitude to stand up to you, or this is not a level playing field." But for whatever reason, the defendant has expressed his decision that he cannot be the one to decide on his own. He cannot resist the pressure. He needs someone to help him protect his privilege against self-incrimination, which is exactly what Miranda's right to counsel was designed to do. It's not a Sixth Amendment lawyer for trial purposes. It is a Fifth Amendment lawyer for the express purpose of helping the defendant protect his privilege against self-incrimination. And Edwards said, "I need a lawyer." To go back hours later, different detectives cooling off, re-Mirandized, none of that addresses his determination. "I can't do this by myself." The only way to address that is to give him his voice. You can scrupulously honor the right to remain silent by giving a person time and space and cooling off, let things chill for a little while. That's honoring what he asked for. You can't honor Edward's request, "I want a lawyer," without getting him the voice. So the court in Edwards corrects this very protective barrier, this magic word, "I want a lawyer," where the police cannot reinitiate custodial interrogation. They cannot prove a waiver. any waiver they get is going to be presumptively invalid. Why? Because the defendant said, I can't decide without a lawyer, and they haven't given him his lawyer. They haven't respected that invocation of his right. Now, the one exception to this is if the defendant initiates the conversation. So, once he says the magic words, I want a lawyer, or get me a lawyer, whatever, once he invokes his right to counsel, all custodial interrogation must cease unless he gets his lawyer. Unless he is the one who initiates the conversation. And again, to make it intuitive, the court treats his initiation of the conversation as him saying, maybe I don't need that lawyer after all. Because, right, on the one hand, he said, I can't do this without a lawyer, but then he's choosing to do it without a lawyer. It undoes his Edward's protections if he initiates the conversation. To comply with the defendant's invocation of the right to counsel, the lawyer has to actually be there during the question, unless the defendant reinitiates. And we'll talk more about what initiation looks like. Putting that aside for a second. To get his defendant and attorney as requested means actually having the defense attorney there during custodial interrogation. Minnick versus Mississippi, your case book summarizes that for you. Sorry. I don't think I'm jumping around. I usually tell you, just so you know that the rhyme to my reason. I give you the page numbers when I think I'm jumping around. Yes.
What happens when the defendant says I want a lawyer, and then they say, fine, I'll get you one, but you know, that's more or less easy on you if you get a lawyer. Then the defendant says, okay, fine, I don't need him, and initiates the conversation. Is that a waiver? Because they're not interrogating him on the crime itself, they're questioning his getting the lawyer.
I know that when. Like one of those things you see on TV. But that to me is, I need to look at that. I don't think it's in your book. My instincts tell me you can't do that if the person's actually in custody. Like, Monica Lindsay, right, said, I asked for my lawyer and they said, this is an offer for you. We're not going to give it to you if you invoke your right to counsel. My view when I read that was that's because she was not in custody, so all of this takes place outside of Miranda. Edwards is very protective. If the defendant unambiguously, and we'll talk about that aspect of it in a second, but if they unambiguously invoke their right to counsel, he's supposed to be in a bubble. And for him to then say, if he says, I need a lawyer to decide whether to talk or not, and then you're trying to argue that he then on his own decided to talk, you're not allowed to even try to argue that. The government's not even allowed to argue that. So I think they would have to argue that his invocation of counsel was ambiguous, okay, which, as we'll talk about in a second, is a good trigger evidence. Okay, but let me, I may have to get back to you with certainty on Thursday. I'm pretty sure I'm like 85% sure I'm right. But look, at least I'm honest, right? I'll tell you Thursday. Okay, so, sorry, I digress. Minnick versus Mississippi, the defendant had invoked his right to counsel after he was arrested for murder. They got him a lawyer. He met a few times with that lawyer, who kept telling the defendant to keep his mouth shut, don't say anything to the police, don't talk to them, don't let them question you, don't sign anything, right? Giving him all of the good advice that defense attorneys generally give a person And then the police wound up reinitiating conversation with the defendant while he was alone. And all of a sudden, the defendant doesn't listen to his attorney. He waives his Miranda rights, or purportedly waives his Miranda rights, and talks. And the court held, admitting that that wasn't respecting the right to counsel. You can't just give him a lawyer and then approach him again when the lawyer is not there. And again, I think the rationale of Edwards is that this is a person who has said, I can't do this on my own. So the lawyer has to actually be there. Now, two questions that come up after Edwards are whether or not the defendant has invoked his right to counsel, whether he actually has Edwards' protections or not, and then secondly, whether he has eradicated Edwards' protections by initiating the conversation. So, did the defendant invoke, this deals with ambiguous requests, Davis versus the United States, the defendant said, maybe I should talk to a lawyer? You see this on TV all the time, right? Do I need a lawyer or something? How serious is this? Do I need a lawyer? Maybe I should be talking to a lawyer? The court held in Davis that that was insufficient to trigger the Edwards protection. That was insufficient to create this barrier between police and the defendant, where anything he did was, any waiver he gave after that moment was presumptively invalid. He just simply say, maybe I should talk to a lawyer, was insufficient. So ambiguous requests will not trigger this Edwards protection. Okay, so if it doesn't trigger Edwards protection, how do we know whether or not Davis's waiver is valid? If he says, I don't know, maybe I should talk to a lawyer, and the police say, up to you, but we find that they get in the way and we're willing to just talk to you. You have these rights, he waives them and answers questions and incriminates himself and moves to suppress. How do we know if that's a valid waiver? Yeah.
If the defendant keeps talking, then it's automatically.
I wouldn't say automatically, but it's not hard to prove a waiver at that point. It's as if he never invoked, he doesn't have one of these magical invocation barriers to waiver. Okay, we're back up at the top of our chart where the government just has to prove a voluntary, knowing, and intelligent waiver. And as Katie said, that's not going to be that hard to prove. The government's going to say, we told him what his rights were. We told him he could get a lawyer. It was up to him. And he continued to talk. Implicitly, that's a waiver. So, it can't be ambiguous. On the other hand, the court isn't going to let the government be hyper-technical here. Defendants are not always, I don't mean this to deride people who get arrested. People who have been put under arrest and are freaking out may not always speak with the eloquence of Barack Obama, or a trained lawyer or something like that. They might not be eloquent. Okay, the question is whether they're ambiguous or not. So in Smith versus Illinois, they said he had a right to a lawyer, and if he couldn't afford one, one would be provided for him. And he said, yeah, I'd like that. And the government tried to argue that that was ambiguous. And the court said, look, there's nothing ambiguous about it. It might not be how we train people to speak. It might be a little valley girl or whatever. Okay. But it's not ambiguous. The person said unambiguously what they wanted. Yeah, I'd like that. So presumably a person who says, I want a lawyer, could say, I want, a lawyer. And that would be okay. That's still unambiguous, even though it's annoying. The other question about the scope of Edwards' protections, if it's triggered, what is it applied to? What's the scope of the protection that it applies to? And this is Arizona versus Roberson. For unrelated crimes. The defendant had been arrested at the crime scene, said he wanted a lawyer. unambiguously. It's trigger of Edwards protection. Then he was warned again and questioned 3 days later. He was in custody the whole time. He's arrested, taken into custody. 3 days later, they go to him about a different crime. Mirandize him. He waives and agrees to speak about this unrelated crime. And the court did something, this is, I really do think, the height of the court's protections against interrogation. The court expands Edwards, I don't know if I call it expands, but interprets Edwards to apply across the board. It is not offense specific. Is not offense specific. Once the defendant said, in response to custodial interrogation, I want a lawyer, that applies whether they're asking him about the offense they originally arrested him for or a different one. Not offense specific. It's extremely protective. If it applies, defendant has to unambiguously vote to make it apply. But if it applies, it's very broad. It applies across the board. Now, the one thing I want to highlight here, and we're going to talk about this again when we get to the Sixth Amendment right to counsel on Thursday, because it'll make more sense then. But I want to put an asterisk here. The Sixth Amendment right to counsel has a similar Edwards approach. If the defendant is indicted and has a Sixth Amendment right to counsel and says, I want a lawyer in the face of interrogation, interrogation has to stop. But the Sixth Amendment right to counsel is offense specific. This is probably the hardest thing we'll do. It's very complicated. So I'm warning you. I told you that I went back and looked at my Crim Pro outline from school and found the areas where I was smart and where I was stupid. Okay. This was one area that, as a student, I never understood, which means I'm going to make you guys understand it. So the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, when we get there, that is offense specific. It only applies to the offenses for which the defendant has been indicted. Miranda's right to counsel is not offense specific. The way I make that make sense in my head is when a defendant's arrested, it's not even clear what the charges are yet. Right? If there's a car accident and the person's drunk and someone dies, the charges could be DUI, it could be reckless driving, it could be manslaughter, it could even be murder in some states. It's not even clear what the charges are. An arrest is an arrest, no matter what the charge was, right? Remember that weird case with the guy who pretended to be a police officer and also recorded the police officer without his consent, and they arrested him for the wrong charge? And the court said all that matters is there has to be PC for some offense. You don't even know what the offense is yet. It doesn't matter as long as there's PC for some offense. And so if it's, Miranda's triggered by custody, and that's different than charges, formal indicted charges. Right, separate from court. It applies just to the custody. That could be for any charge. We don't know yet. The prosecutor hasn't indicted. The Sixth Amendment right to counsel, though, represents something only on the indictment. That is offense specific. At that point, it makes sense to start talking about charges. To make this a little more intuitive, if you're a public defender and you represent somebody on a DUI, and you find out the police are also investigating him in a stabbing that happened 2 years earlier, that's not your case. Right? You represent him on the DUI. You're going to tell him, until you're indicted for the stabbing, I've got nothing to do with this. Okay. You're going to have to hire yourself a lawyer if you want somebody to represent you on that. Okay, so that's how I make sense intuitively, but just a heads up on that, that when we get to the Sixth Amendment, we're going to have to revisit this issue. All right, so it's not offense specific. Oh, one other thing to make this even more complicated. Look at McNeil versus Wisconsin at page 778 of your case book. This deals with the question of which right to counsel has the defendant invoked. Right? Because obviously the defendant, he wants the golden protection of a defendant against interrogation. He wants non-offense-specific Edwards protection, right? He wants the thing that keeps the police from talking to him even 3 days later about a different crime. So the defendant's going to try to argue in every instance that if he said, I want a lawyer, he was invoking his Fifth Amendment right to counsel. Because that gets him this non-offense specific, broader Edwards protection against the waiver. In McNeil versus Wisconsin, the defendant was at in court, had an appearance on formal charges. So he wasn't being arrested. He was after the investigative stage of the case. He wasn't being interrogated. He was being charged. He was in court. And the judge said, you have the right to have a lawyer represent you on this case. That's a Sixth Amendment right to counsel. The defendant said, yeah, I want that. I want a lawyer. After that, the police went to him and questioned him about a different offense. He's on trial for charge X. Defense lawyer, blah, 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 represents him on X. They go to him and custodially interrogate him on Y. He tries to argue, I didn't validly waive my Miranda rights because I was in Edwards' land. I had invoked my right to counsel. They're not allowed to question me. And what the Scalia held in McNeil is that what the defendant invoked in at arraignment was only his Sixth Amendment right to counsel, not his Fifth Amendment right to counsel, and therefore it applied only to charge X, not to charge Y. So again, just to make clear we know where we are on here, if that happens, defendant's arraigned on charge X, he asked for a lawyer to represent him on charge X, he invokes his Sixth Amendment right to counsel on X. The police 3 days later arrest him for Y, a robbery. Read him his Miranda rights, he waives and answers questions and incriminates himself on the robbery. He moves to suppress that confession when he's later charged with robbery. How do we know whether that waiver is valid or not? Mark? If the defendant invokes his right to counsel on a trial, okay, or he's not in custody, he's not being interrogated, he says, I want a lawyer to represent me for, you know, spouse abuse, I hit my wife. He's pending trial on a DV case, he has a lawyer on a DV case. 3 days later, the police arrest him for committing a robbery, Mirandize him, he confesses. How do we know if his waiver is valid?
Well, this, the other case has nothing to do with the Sixth Amendment. If they Mirandize him and he waived him.
Okay, what test do we apply to know whether that waiver is valid? What does the government have to prove about the waiver? Okay, we're just back at the top of our chart. So the only question we're talking about now, I just want to make sure you don't lose the forest through the trees. I'm really bad at idioms. Has to do with my mother speaking a second language. She's really bad with idioms. I'm in a weird mood. So did the defendant invoke, all of this is a question of did the defendant have Edwards protections or not. If he doesn't have Edwards protections, it doesn't make the waiver automatically valid. It just puts us back into a world where it's relatively easy to prove a waiver, knowing voluntary intelligence. Okay. So one more issue on this McNeil versus Wisconsin thing, because I do think this is a little tricky. There's a footnote in McNeil versus Wisconsin. McNeil versus Wisconsin, I don't think the outcome is that counterintuitive, right? He's in court on X, saying, I'm getting a lawyer for X, and then trying to use that as a reason to protect himself on a completely different charge, where he could have invoked his Fifth Amendment right to counsel, but did not. The thing that's interesting about McNeil versus Wisconsin is Scalia drops a footnote and says, it remains to be determined whether a defendant can ever anticipatorily invoke his Miranda rights. So the defendant tried to argue, I was anticipatorily invoking my right to have a lawyer not just to represent me in court, I was also implicitly telling the government, don't come question me about this case. Don't come custodially interrogate me about this case. And if he does that, if it's a Fifth Amendment invocation of counsel, that is not offense-specific, right? So he was trying to argue I was invoking both. So we adopt this footnote saying we're not convinced that you can ever anticipatorily invoke your Miranda right to counsel. Lower courts have gone with it. Lower courts have said you can't get this super magical, ultra-protective Edwards protection unless you invoke the right to counsel in the setting of custodial interrogation. It has to be in the face of imminent custodial interrogation when they're reading you your Miranda warnings that you say, I want a lawyer. So if that's right, under that result, a defendant could not find, he found out that he was a suspect. Right? I'm trying to think of a case where somebody, oh, that Long Island case, right, where that teacher, the substitute teacher, her evil husband, he cheats on her, gets caught, and then kills her. So he killed her, what was it, like 2 weeks ago, right? Did you guys read about that? And leaves her car on the side of the road for like 2 days, right? Everybody knew he did it. I knew he did it. but, you know, he's walking around free. He hasn't been arrested yet. His foot hasn't dropped yet. He hasn't known he was a suspect. I'm sure they were treating him like a suspect. What this footnote in McNeil versus Wisconsin means is during that phase, when he's not in custody, when he's not being interrogated, when he's not being Mirandized, if he were to write a letter to the police precinct saying, I am invoking my Edwards protection, you cannot anticipatorily invoke Edwards, the court said. So if he were to write that letter saying, I want a lawyer before you custodially interrogate me, the implication of that footnote is the police could ignore that, arrest him, Mirandize him, and then if he started yapping, he wouldn't be an Edwards land, he'd be at the top of our chart. So the court in that footnote suggests that to invoke Edwards, it's got to be a situation where the defendant is facing the pressures that are attendant to custodial interrogation. And then he has to say, I need a lawyer. Or, I want a lawyer. Or, oh, yeah, I'd like it. One last issue on this is, so we've been talking about whether the defendant gets Edwards protection, right? Has he triggered that? It needs to be unambiguous. If it is, it's a very broad protection. It's not offense specific. But what the defendant gives himself as protection, he can lose if he initiates conversation. And that's, look at Oregon versus Bradshaw in your book at. Oregon versus Bradshaw deals with this question of initiating the conversation. The defendant was arrested, Mirandized, invoked his right to counsel unambiguously, and the police respected it. To respect it, it doesn't mean that they have to get him a lawyer immediately. It just means that they have to get him a lawyer if they're going to custodially interrogate him. If they don't custodially interrogate him, they don't have to get him a lawyer. Haven't you seen movies, right, where they say, I want a lawyer, and then, like, 2 hours later, they're still saying, where's my lawyer? Because the police don't have to get the defendant a lawyer. They only have to get him a lawyer to deal with the pressures of custodial interrogation. As long as there's no custodial interrogation, the defendant doesn't really have a right to a lawyer. So the defendant invokes in Bradshaw, he says, I want a lawyer. They don't get him a lawyer. But they also don't interrogate him. They leave him alone. Then they're driving him to jail. And he says to the person driving him, the police officer driving him, what's going to happen to me now? The police officer starts telling him about what he can expect to happen to him now. And then suggests, you know, why don't you take a lie detector test? You can help yourself out. You can avoid all this. Why don't you sit down with the polygraph machine? The defendant takes it. and winds up confessing. Redford's wife writes for a plurality and says that that is initiation for Edward's purposes. That it was open-ended enough to be seen as a generalized introducing and inviting, a generalized discussion about the investigation. The defendants tried to argue, no, it was an incident to the custodial relationship. It was like asking, what booking facility are you going to take me to? Or, you know, will it hurt when they fingerprint me? Or are they going to take my picture? These kinds of questions that somebody might ask only about their custodial status. The court said, no, that's not what you did. You said what's going to happen to me, and now, which was a much broader discussion about what was going to happen in the investigation. Justice Powell concurs, he's the fifth vote, to say that there was no Edwards protection. And he says, well, let's just look at the totality of the circumstances. This was a valid waiver. Lower courts use that Rehnquist approach to the question of whether or not the defendant has initiated. So unless it's an extremely narrow question, courts might find that the defendant has initiated the conversation, in which case Edwards' protection is gone. Now, just to make sure you guys can. So if a defendant is arrested, he's read his rights, he invokes, he says, I want a lawyer, and the police just sit there with him and don't silence until the guy finally says, you know, I didn't do it. And the police say, follow up on that and have a conversation, and he winds up incriminating himself. How do we know whether the defendant waived or not? How do we know if it's a valid waiver? Okay, we're back at the top of the chart again. The one thing I just want to make sure you guys don't skip that step. So just because the defendant initiates the conversation doesn't automatically make it a valid waiver, it means he doesn't have Edwards protection. Then you have to go back to the underlying standard of whether it was knowing voluntary intelligence, and that's not going to be so hard to show. But you do have to go through, you know, that litigation. Why did defendants initiate the conversation? And the court gives, I mean, Edward is incredibly protective. I want a lawyer. Our magic words are supposed to be. And they're not even offense specific. Why does that work? For the police to say, fine, and then just sit there. Maybe give them a soda, drink a soda, a sandwich, in silence. Why would someone initiate a conversation?
People talk.
I mean, look at me, right? Every once in a while, I just go. People, silence is unbelievable. I don't know how many of you, if you take skills classes on client interviewing or even in deposition, one of the tricks that you'll read about is actually using silence. Right? So if you meet with a client for the very first time and they're telling you their side of the story or they're telling you what your problem is, sometimes the worst thing to do, as a matter of skill, is to be intervening constantly with a bunch of follow-up questions. Sometimes the best thing you can do is just sit in silence, because then the person will follow up on their own and tell you what is really important that they didn't tell you initially and that you might not have known to follow up on in your own rapid-fire questions. Silence is incredibly powerful. And I saw it all the time in practice where defense. Every once in a while, you get a defendant with some fortitude who said, I want a lawyer, and they just can't keep their mouth shut. They just can't keep their mouth shut. And it's like this psychological game of who can wait out the other person longer. You know, the drive from the police station to the booking facility can take a really long time. And just be sitting there in total silence or sitting across an interrogation table from two police officers just in silence. Can be too much for people. It takes incredible fortitude to just sit and keep your mouth shut. It's almost easier to do it when the detectives are asking you questions. than to do it when it's quiet. Because eventually people will say, you've got it all wrong, or I didn't do it. And they use that time not to practice fortitude. They use that time to think of a story. Right? They're using that time to think, what can I say? How can I get out of this? How can I avoid sleeping in jail tonight? And eventually, instead of waiting for a lawyer to come, who's never going to come, right? In a lot of cases, the police will just forego questioning rather than get the lawyer. They eventually will start saying whatever story it is that they have come up with in their time thinking. So that happens a lot. Let me run a couple more hypotheticals by you just to make sure we've gotten stuff before we move on. If the defendant is arrested for robbery, he is Mirandized and invokes. He says, I want a lawyer. Ironically, that night, while he's in the holding cell, they get a report that his own house is broken into. The defendant's own house is broken into. They go to his cell to see if he knows who might have done this. He tells them who might have broken into his house, and it turns out to be related to the robbery that he was involved in, like a tit for tat. So his answer winds up incriminating him. He moves to suppress. What result? That is the cutest thing I've ever heard. Okay, so what are the issues there? Yes.
So he's arrested for robbery, he asked for a lawyer when they ran this, and he said,
yes. Okay. He says, I want a lawyer. So he's got Edward's protections, right?
And then he's just sitting there talking. And that's close. That is, since it's Fifth Amendment, it's not offense specific, but it's not his offense they're asking about. They're asking about somebody else's offense that
yeah.
he possibly couldn't have done, but it ends up implicating it. Is that
yes.
Okay.
They go to talk to him about a crime where he's the victim. His answer winds up incriminating. He moves to the front. Saying he violated Edward.
I would say, like Phil said, because they're not asking about his conduct, they're asking about somebody else's conduct, that Edward wouldn't really apply. They're not questioning about acts he's done. They're asking about things that have been done to him.
Okay, and where on the doctrinal chart have we learned something that addresses what you're saying? It is on the can't read all of it. Can't fit it all.
Could that possibly be a public safety exception? That
no.
Sorry.
You're on the right piece of paper. This is all grounded in custodial interrogation. The person with Edward's protection, they can ask him what food he wants for dinner. They can ask him whether he prefers Taco Bell or Burger King. That's why it's not interrogation or the functional equivalent. Well, in this hypothetical, here's the issue, I think, right? You walked us through the first part pretty well there initially. You've got Edward's protection. That involves not just the robbery he's been arrested for, but any other offenses as well. But what Edward and Miranda generally protect people against is custodial interrogation. And interrogation is express questioning or the functional equivalent, which is words or conduct that an officer should know is reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. Well, here he's the victim. The police don't, there's no reason to think that that's reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response. It'd be different if I set up the facts where a reasonable officer would think the answer is going to incriminate him. But if they really thought he was the victim, there was no reason to think what he said was going to incriminate him. It would be like asking him, do you want Burger King or Taco Bell? It's going to him as the victim, saying, help us solve this crime that's been committed against you. That falls outside of Miranda. Defendant is arrested and Mirandized and says, should I have an attorney for this? And the detective just keeps asking questions. Defendant waives and answers and incriminates him, moves to suppress. That one.
I would say that he is protected because he wasn't given the option of saying, well, you can have an attorney if you want to, but I've been saying, should I get into an administrative that he's not there? Oh, no.
Okay, so the court says that it has to be an explicit invocation in Davis. Ambiguous requests are not only insufficient, I'm glad we touched on it. It's not only insufficient to trigger Edwards, but it doesn't trigger a duty to inquire. It doesn't trigger an obligation to clarify or anything. It is the same. The defendant's saying some ambiguous thing. Do I need a lawyer for this? The court treats it as insignificant. The police don't have to clarify any of it. They don't have to say, well, I don't know, are you saying you want a lawyer? Because the police know that if they say, are you saying you want a lawyer? The person's going to say, yeah, I'd like that. Okay, that's unambiguous. So what they tend to do is either ignore it or they'll say, like your point earlier, they'll say something like, well, I don't know if that's really going to be in your interest. They might actually dissuade the person from getting a lawyer. Okay, but they're not probably likely to clarify that and say, is this what you want? Okay. And the court doesn't impose upon them any obligation to do that under Davis. But again, to be clear, if that So if that does happen, if the police just run right over him and say, just keep asking him questions, how do we know if his waiver is valid? How do we know if the defendant's validly waived or not? We don't apply Edwards, right? So what do we apply? Okay, it's got to be voluntary, knowing, and intelligent. And here that might get litigated, right? Because when you talk about whether something's voluntary, it's totality of the circumstances. The defendant's going to point to the fact that he said this ambiguous thing. They might point to the fact that if they do something like saying, I don't know, that might not help you, they tend to get in the way, if they dissuade the person from getting a lawyer, it's going to be a factor in whether or not the defendant's subsequent waiver is voluntary, but it's not going to be determinative. It goes into the mix, but none of it's sufficient to trigger Edwards. Does that make sense? Right. If you guys have what questions do you have about Miranda before we close the book? Nothing? All of my hypotheticals? So I think if you got all this, do you guys want these on twin? I'll put these on twin. Okay, so look for custody, look for interrogation. If neither one of those is there, it's outside Miranda. There's either warnings or not. And then a lot of the action happens on waiver. And the main thing, you know, you've got to get Edwards down, the nooks and crannies of Edwards. It's got to be unambiguous, it's not offense specific. It's invalidated if the defendant initiates. But if Edwards is gone, that's not the end of the question. You've got to go back up to this catch-all standard. Yeah.
So if you say that the courts aren't really concerned with the psychological balance, as long as the defendant is aware of his rights, like, you know, that issue, that moment of silence where you sit across from the defendant, for, you know, that seems to be the type of thing that Brian is concerned about.
I know.
That story, you know, sweating a map, sitting there and really making you feel guilty. But then there was that, I forget which case we were talking about today, but as long as you know what the rights are told to you, you might not have to know the implications of them and so on.
Yeah.
So it seems like courts are just more interested, not necessarily in balancing, like they were with Miranda, they're okay with psychological pressure, as long as it's observed in the environment, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the irony to all of this is Miranda was supposed to be so transformative. It was supposed to protect these people who can't keep their mouths shut, right? And presumably it was meant to erect a huge barrier to law enforcement. It was so controversial at the time that everybody assumed Miranda warnings were going to work. If law enforcement had known ex ante that psychologically Miranda warnings don't do anything, people hear it and then continue to dig themselves into a hole. Miranda would have been something police would come up with. This help, kind of helping police, and I think it's telling that law enforcement agencies filed amicus briefs in favor of the defendant in Dickerson. Because they like Miranda. Why do they like Miranda? Because it doesn't keep anybody from confessing. And it makes it easier to get the confession in because the police can point to the Miranda warning and say to him, we told him he had a right to remain silent. We told him he had a right to a lawyer. We told him we'd pay for it. And he talked to us anyway. It winds up being the most compelling proof to prove voluntariness, both in the waiver context in Miranda and in the due process context. It's just like when we talked about the free to leave test, right? We said a really smart police officer will say, you don't have to talk to me, but, or you're free to leave, but you mind talking to me about drugs. Why? Because even though they say you're free to leave, most people don't have the fortitude to walk away from a police officer, and then they're telling the person they were free to leave helps show that the decision to stay there was voluntary. That's what Miranda warnings wind up doing in confession life, right? People don't listen. They don't exert their privileges because they're weak, and we all live to babble, and we don't want to go to jail. We try to talk our way out of it. And then the police use the warning, which does no good to the defendant's psychology, as proof that the defendant was doing all this voluntarily. So that's my soapbox. That's my team. Okay, so next class, we'll do the blog on the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, which you've already started, presumably. So block 18, yes, for Thursday.